Bankruptcy Institute. We're here for another in a series of interviews we've been conducting with bankruptcy professionals. Today's interview is highly timely because not long ago a jury in Houston, Texas, brought in verdicts of guilty against Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling for their roles in the events leading up to the collapse of the Enron Corporation, perhaps the most celebrated debtor in bankruptcy history. Our guest has special advantages in watching the collapse of Enron. Nancy Rappaport is the editor of a book on Enron, and she played a prominent role in a documentary film about the company's collapse. She's a recognized authority on issues of professional responsibility in bankruptcy cases, and until just lately, she was dean of the law school in Enron's hometown, Houston, Texas. Nancy Rappaport, welcome to ABI Podcast.
Well, thank you.
Nancy, you know who Brad DeLong is, the Berkeley economist and blogger?
I've definitely heard of him.
Okay. For set up, you may have seen a bit from DeLong's blog earlier this week. He was reviewing Kurt Eichenwald's book called Conspiracy of Fools, a True Story. And DeLong amused me. He says, it's interesting. He says, Eichenwald has written a huge book, 800 pages, and at the end of it, a casual reader has no understanding of why Enron went bankrupt. Nancy, do you think you understand why Enron went bankrupt?
I think I understand part of why Enron went bankrupt, at least.
I can try one more line from that, not to read it forever, but he says, Enron reported $11 billion of stockholders' equity at the end of 2000. It made an additional $2 billion or so during the great raid on California in 2001. Yet by September of 2001, it had $30 billion in debt, $10 billion of which was coming due in the next year, and had no net cash flow. Right. That sounds familiar, doesn't it?
It does, and I think that's pretty accurate.
So why did Enron go bankrupt?
I think it went bankrupt for a couple of reasons. One is it drifted away from its main business purpose, which was it had real assets. It was an energy company. It did energy things, and those things drive the economy. As it went farther and farther afield, in part because of the personalities at the top, and it went less into real tangible things and more into not just intangible, but impractical things. At the time it was doing it, it also lost track of basic business principles. Two in particular. One is, it is useful to know where your cash is. And two, it is probably a good idea not to lie.
Just occurred to me to wonder whether the Commerce Department has an industry quote for a grand theft. let's do a little background here. I gather you grew up in Houston, right?
I grew up about 90 miles from Houston, so when I was growing up, Houston was growing up from a medium-sized city to the fourth largest that it is right now.
But I didn't realize you were a country girl then.
Sadly, yes, but I'm a city girl now, and I'm much, much happier.
You used to dream of getting to Houston, and you finally got there.
I used to dream of getting into Beaumont, which was the next biggest town over, but now at least I'm back in Houston.
Yeah, okay. Where'd you go to school?
Undergrad, I went to Rice University, which is now headed, just to date this podcast, and I must, to the College World Series in baseball yet again.
All right.
And after Rice, I went out west to Stanford for law school.
And I believe you were at Morrison & Foerster in San Francisco for a while, right?
I was. I started right after law school. I clerked for Judge Snead on the Ninth Circuit and then started practicing with Morrison & Foerster, and I got very well trained on how to be a good lawyer at that firm.
Oh, okay. Then take me through your teaching career. Went to what, Ohio State?
Started at The Ohio State University in 1991 and went from assistant professor to associate professor with tenure. Then the then dean, Greg Williams, decided that we should add associate dean to my title. That didn't frighten me, so in 1998, I left Ohio State and actually became the dean at the University of Nebraska.
That's Nebraska, but somehow you get back to Houston.
I did. 2 years later, Houston wooed me home, and it was really nice to get home to my family and to get back to a state that I think I understand a little better than I understand any of the other states we've lived in.
Interesting. But, there'll be a certain irony here in a moment, won't there?
I think yes.
Now, by the time you got the, I think it's fair to say that you pretty much established yourself as an authority on bankruptcy law, in particular on professional responsibility in bankruptcy cases.
Well, that's the part that always intrigued me about practice, was the intersection between what the statute says in bankruptcy and the behavior of bankruptcy lawyers in trying to carry out that statute.
Just to tie all this together, will we agree that there's some overlap between the issues of professional responsibility and managing corporate bankruptcies and the issues of professional responsibility and managing corporations outside of bankruptcy?
I think there is a huge amount of overlap, and I still think that most of professional responsibility can be boiled down into the things that I should have learned in kindergarten. But then there's no scholarly stuff that comes out of that, so we have to make it sound fancier.
Oh, okay, good. Well, you get back to Houston in 2000. With the benefit of the kindergarten education and other things.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. And at that point, I guess it would be that Enron's riding high in Houston, aren't they, when you get back there?
Not only was Enron riding high when I first got back, it was one of the biggest law firms in the city, with over 240, 250 lawyers just in its downtown location.
Some of them perhaps are graduates?
A lot of them are graduates, because one of the things that Enron was known for was hiring a lot of the best and brightest. And I was so enamored of the company when I got back and became dean at U of H, I had a fantasy that we could be the first law school named after a company for the right price. At least I would have asked for cash.
No, I mean, connect the dots there. You suggested to the management that they make a deal with Enron to call you the Enron Law School.
It would have been great. At the time, that Enron was one of the biggest corporate donors in Houston, and when you walked into the Enron building, it's everything about Enron was flashing on the walls, and the stock prices and the advertisements and what industries they were getting into next. And it was a really exciting place.
So I got, help me with this. Did the idea just kind of trickle away, or did somebody look at you and say, Nancy, that's not a good idea?
You know, this was part of where they started shaking their heads at me and tisking and wondering what they'd gotten themselves into when they'd hired me as the dean. It was a little bit too unusual for U of H. So was my proposal about 4 years later that we should have bought the Enron building out of bankruptcy, but then not everybody likes buying things out of bankruptcy. Bankruptcy lawyers do. It's a great title.
That's jumping ahead. Who did buy the building finally?
The bank's credit bid it in.
Okay.
So every time I drive by, I keep thinking, for $51 million, we could have been above ground.
No, this is a sidetrack, but I can think of two. I think there are three law schools in the country that are built in buildings that were otherwise abandoned.
Well, you know, and I thought the karma would have been nice. If, in fact, Enron wasn't lying about how nice the high-speed internet was in that building, we could have reversed the karma.
Uh-huh. So you come back to Houston as dean. Enron is riding high. Sounds like you start meeting Enron lawyers at alumni parties and things of that sort.
Absolutely. Did a pitch about how University of Houston's Law Center was going to do more with the city of Houston and with important businesses like Enron. And then I'm reading the morning paper, and I think it was about October of 2001.
I don't want to get there quite yet. I want to suck up that scene a little bit.
Okay.
Houston, in 2000, early 2001, I mean, you're a social person, and you have to be in the social world as a dean. Tell me about Enron in Houston a little bit.
Everywhere you looked, at every major arts function and every major educational function, Enron was at the table as one of the biggest donors.
Yeah.
And Houston, people don't really think of Houston as an arts city, but it is. We have one of the best operas in the country.
Yeah.
Good symphony, good ballet, good museum.
I would agree that Houston is either second or tenth or someplace in between.
I like to think of it as tied for first, but then I'm not willing to recognize any of the other cities as first. It's a really, really good opera. But every time you looked at the corporate sponsors, which is secretly what all deans do at intermission anyway, Enron was right at the top of the list, and Ken Lay was the face of Houston. He was the face of Houston inside Texas and D.C. and literally all over the world.
Even though you didn't get the corporate sponsorship, was Enron a direct donor to the law school?
Not so much to the law school, but we still have at U of H the Enron Teaching Excellence Award, and I think one unfilled chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You still have in Houston the Enron Stadium?
You know, that was the sad thing. When they took the name off, and personally. I think they sold it out of the estate at too low a price, and it became Minute Maid Park. I think it would have been a much better sale to call it Field formerly known as Enron.
I think somebody told me the other day that if Colonel Sanders endowed part of a museum, if you call it the Kentucky Fried Chicken Wing.
Oh, no, I like that. That's good.
So here's Enron all over the place, all buzz. You talk about your graduates. We've chatted about this kind of thing before. I think you said among other things they were a bright bunch.
They really were. What these folks were who got picked off by Enron and also, ironically, by Arthur Andersen if they went the accounting way, these are the people who were highly driven, very much self-starters, very much knew they were smart and wanted to test their mettle at the next big thing.
But it's along about, well, I guess October probably, right?
Yep.
2001, wouldn't it be?
It was.
You hear this rumble and this giant piece of ice starts to fall off the glacier there?
Yep, it hits the deck.
Yes, recall the narrative a little bit there. What happened in October 2001?
Around then, the Wall Street Journal started talking about an unusual relationship between a business organization set up by Enron's chief financial officer, Andrew Fastow, and Enron, and it was trying to figure out why exactly is the chief financial officer sitting across the table from Enron doing side deals with Enron. And it started just steamrolling after that. It was fascinating. There was one article, and then there were several articles. And then suddenly I went from reading three papers in a half an hour to reading three papers in an hour and a half, because then the New York Times jumped in and it started to cover it, and then the weekly news magazines pitched in. And they all started saying the same thing. This doesn't make any sense. This was a company that was listed for years running as the sixth most innovative company in the country, and it was doing things that your basic first-year business student wouldn't have done.
All of a sudden you got top management saying we are being ripped off by our chief financial officer.
Yeah, and that was one of the defenses in the criminal trial. Mm-hmm. It wasn't us, it was Andy.
Mm-hmm. I think that's okay. Well, there's at least a patina of truth there, isn't it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know. I think certainly Fastow, Enron couldn't have done a lot of what it did without him.
But I guess the record is that it was the deals that Fastow struck and put together were a good deal of Enron's come up.
But the other thing, the jury actually said we weren't that impressed with listening to Fastow either way. We knew he was a crook. We were looking at the other folks.
Sure. Yeah, I know I didn't mean to contradict him.
Yeah.
The question has to be how much other people were participants in, or at least aware of the deal that he was struck.
Exactly. And the shoes that have been dropping left and right include a lot of the banks that knew full well what was going on with these deals, or at least their emails, which no one ever believes will be reproduced, invariably got reproduced, and they would say things like, this is the usual deal, Enron's going to take us out within 6 months, it's not really a purchase.
Okay, these are bank emails now?
These are bank emails.
Okay, good. Don't worry about what the deal says, this is what it really is.
Exactly, so much for true sales.
Okay. Anyway, we started reading these odd Wall Street Journal stories in the October of 2001, and then it really all unraveled at pretty much warp speed then, didn't it?
It did. It was interesting. One of the fun things about being a dean is that you get to go out to lunch with a lot of people you otherwise wouldn't meet, and I was having lunch with Dynegy's legal team the day before Dynegy and Enron announced that they were planning to merge.
Or remind us who Dynegy is.
Dynegy was one of the other big energy companies in Houston's energy corridor, which is all a part of downtown. There's Dynegy in El Paso and Enron and Shell and all of these companies probably within a 20-block radius. And Dynegy was a big one, and the idea was that Dynegy was going to help save Enron. Oh. And when that deal unraveled, that was the beginning of the real end.
Why do you think the Dynegy deal did unravel?
Dynegy, apparently, when it had agreed to the deal, hadn't seen all the financials. And the more financials they saw, the less they made sense.
Is it the case that Dynegy got in there and said, oh, my God, we never guessed it was like this?
That's what I think. And certainly what the president of Dynegy said afterwards.
And then I guess the bankruptcy filing was it December of that same year?
It was December. It was over a weekend, the way truly large bankruptcy filings sometimes are.
Straight in the principles of the court, they're always open, huh?
Exactly. And with electronic filing, they actually are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was, it really took everyone's breath away.
Sunday afternoon, yeah. It was in the bankruptcy by December of 2001. Of course, the case, I guess, is Locust in New York, right? You
know? Yeah, that really annoyed us. We have perfectly wonderful bankruptcy judges in Houston, and yet it was based in New York.
You're all talking about which lawyers would have had the positions if the case had been filed down there, right?
Well, the one thing I did see is that if you don't want to get shot at, it's probably a good idea to not file a bankruptcy like this in one's hometown.
Huh.
All of the businesses that feed into supporting the employees at Enron are still angry to this day about what it did to their own businesses. Dry cleaners and coffee shops and the like.
Well, so Enron by 2001, or by the end of the year 2001, has, oh, do you call it a melange or a mishmash, or what do you call it? Some hard asset energy companies, some trading companies, some smoke and mirrors companies, and I don't know, am I overlooking anything?
Well, let's see. They had invested in everything from selling remaining broadband capacity and weather futures and power plants in countries that couldn't support them, and water companies that were undercapitalized on the days that literally the day they began.
Mm-hmm. Did they have their own navy?
Not yet, but that was the only thing they were missing.
Well, that's right. But the energy trading part of it and similar trading aspects of it, am I right to infer those businesses pretty much unraveled in a cloud of smoke, didn't they?
Well, a lot of the trading, it stayed a little bit because it was able to exploit some loopholes in regulations, especially in California. But when they were trading hard assets, when they were trading, well, I don't know if you call a blip of electricity a hard asset or a blip of electricity, when they were trading things that they had not also made up, that still went on reasonably well for a while. When they were trading things that only existed in their own imaginations, that went poof overnight.
Well, that's interesting, because I was thinking of cases like Drexel Burnham before Enron, and I guess Refco after Enron.
Right.
Companies that are predicated on trading didn't tend to disappear in a cloud of smoke. But if I heard you right, you said it might not have been quite that way.
I don't think it. There's still a lot of trading that goes on today, although I think that the days of people saying burn, baby, burn, and telling plants to shut off so that they could export power and then import it back. Those days are gone.
Yeah. But it filed in 2001. Now let's go back. I want to look at in these days. I guess we can all identify the people who knew something about Enron. Who knew about Enron before the roof fell in?
There were a few people who really were proven right all along. One of them was Bethany McLean and Peter Elkind, who wrote the book Smartest Guys in the Room.
And Bethany, I guess, was the fortune reporter. Wasn't
she? She was the woman who wrote Is Enron Stock Overpriced?
Okay.
And what she said is
10 months before October?
Several months. This is stuff that I'm still hitting the palm of my hand on my forehead for not having discovered long before Enron went south. Because it was an article saying, isn't it unusual that for a company that's not in a cyclical business, that cash flow goes down and down and down and down and down until the end of the quarter, and then it shoots right back up, and then it goes down and down and down and down and down again. And isn't it funny that all of their deals happen at the very end of quarters and years?
We've got this extraordinary, sapient, and I guess also courageous young woman there at Fortune who belongs to, she gets a place on the honor roll, doesn't she?
She certainly does. John Olson at Merrill Lynch.
Who's John Olson?
John Olson was an analyst who said Enron doesn't make sense. And for his services, he got fired because Enron didn't want anyone saying it.
Am I right that he was working for a small analysis company there in Houston?
I want to say he was at a big one for a while.
Okay. Maybe. Okay. I don't know where your opera company ranks. Maybe I don't know where.
Well, you know, let me just say the opera company is world class, but that's a separate issue.
I know. I think I'll have to take note of that.
Okay.
So we got John Olson. We got Bethany McLean. Is it? Okay.
Yes. And there were a few other people, but
well, there seemed to have been some short sellers out there, weren't there?
Well, at least Ken Lay referenced those in his criminal trial. Yeah. But I will also say that there were some very prominent Houston investors, people who held the money of the rich and famous, who never, ever bought a share of Enron stock. And one of the most famous is Fayez Serafin, who invests for...
I hadn't heard of until I talked to you.
Yes. But what he had said is, I don't understand it. I can't understand it from reading the financials. If I cannot understand it, I am not investing in it.
So Well, now you're fresh down from Nebraska.
Which is the Warren Buffett philosophy, if I can't understand it. And actually, that's a really good way to think about investing in companies. I think so.
I'm curious about, you know, going to parties, being in the social swim of the dean has to be in this sort of situation. Did you run across people in Houston who were saying, you know, Enron, I don't know. Did you run across any of them?
Not a soul. Not until afterwards. And then apparently everyone always knew someone who had thought something was up. But at the time, it was almost as if the seas parted when Ken and Linda Lay walked into a room. They were Houston royalty.
Okay. Have you kept count? I know that there's more than one. There are more than two books about Enron. Now, how many books about Enron are there?
Well, when we came out, we were about 84. And I want to say there's about 110, something like that.
About 110? How many have you read?
I have read 110.
All right.
I own 110 of them. I own the ones that include the self-published ones, the unauthorized Enron joke book, and a lot of things that were bound from the Senate testimony. It's a very strange library in our office at home.
Well, I was wondering if you had to build a wing for that.
Actually, I've had to stack them.
Okay.
They make lovely coffee tables.
Do you have a quick answer as to which are the good ones?
I think among the good ones, I do think Smartest Guys in the Room is very good.
Smartest Guys in the Room is the...
Is the McLean Elkin book. I think that The Crooked E was interesting just from the perspective of an insider. It was juicy, and CBS made it into a movie, a very bad movie.
Crooked E, after that famous, what do you call it, trademark logo?
Exactly. The one that in Conspiracy of Fools, which is a very good book as well, they pointed out that Enron's first name was Enteron, which meant intestine.
Okay.
But Power Failure was a good book, and I think Mimi Schwartz's book that she wrote with Sharon Watkins was interesting as a glimpse of Enron through Sharon Watkins' eyes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and among the 110, are you counting your own?
I like our book. I like our book quite a lot. I also like the cover art, which my husband drew.
Okay. Well, tell me about your book.
Our book is, the theory is, we get
they
these...
They are. Who's your co-author?
Oh, first, the most important collaborator besides my husband, who quietly edited everything for us behind the scenes, Bala Duran, an accounting professor at Rice University. And he is... I actually think accounting is interesting. He makes it fun. He makes it captivating, and I heard him speak once.
Let me tell you a secret, Nancy. It's fun to teach.
It is, I guess, but, you know, he captures the ambiguity in it that makes accounting interesting.
Have you and Duran, had you met him before, or did you?
I spoke on a panel with him, and I noticed right away that his students would follow him around like little imprinted ducklings. And then I got to know him, and he's amazing. And so he and I came up with a list of folks we wanted to contribute to the book, and we split up the editing functions. And it's a book designed to be a companion piece for business schools and law schools and someday, I hope, even undergraduate institutions so that we can figure out, really, all of the things that went wrong at Enron and maybe learn a little bit about how we can change our own behavior to fix some of it.
We'll be back right after break.
Pause this week's podcast to bring you bankruptcy in the news. Last Friday, Judge Robert Drain allowed REFCO's creditors to expand their investigation of the bankrupt commodities company's 2005 collapse. Judge Drain ordered several former REFCO executives and insiders to provide information about lost company assets. The creditors' committee had been looking to expand its probe, saying it had identified several former REFCO executives who might have knowledge about the location of assets lost in the company's demise. REFCO was once one of the largest commodity brokerages in the U.S., but collapsed into bankruptcy after an accounting scandal. The company's former chief executive, Philip R. Bennett, is accused of hiding hundreds of millions of dollars in bad debt. The investigation by REFCO's creditors committee has allowed it to obtain $750 million in settlements so far. Judge Drain also ordered three accounting firms to turn over records related to the creditors' investigation. He gave Ernst & Young, PricewaterhouseCoopers, and the now-defunct Arthur Andersen 20 days to turn over the additional records. This has been John Hartgen of the ABI. Thank you for listening, and now back to this week's podcast.
Got the book, which is mostly was with the Foundation book.
Foundation Press, and 950 pages exactly, not like I'm counting or anything.
I can see my copy across the room right now. I don't have 108 others.
The, available at fine used bookstores everywhere in your college campuses.
Yes. And there's something about a movie also. So tell me about the movie.
The movie was great. I was speaking at a local event, and a woman who was a former Enron employee came up to me, and she said, "They're shooting a movie. Would you mind if I told them about you?" And
this is a lousy CBS movie.
No, this is the one that was up for an Academy Award. It's called Enron, the Smartest Guys in the Room. World premiere in Houston.
You get beat up by a bunch of penguins, right?
I did. I was very disappointed by that. But the penguins look better in tuxedos than many of the players in the Enron movie.
That's distracting. Tell me about the movie. What did they all do in the movie?
Well, it was interesting. It's a documentary, and like almost all documentaries, it was produced from a particular point of view. But I thought that Alex Gibney, who did the movie, did a very good job about pulling the pieces of Enron together and why it was such a bizarre story. And it was a bizarre story in part because of the personalities, and in part because it interwove how the regulations let them get away with it. And also because it was fun to have 14 people in our living room for 3 hours so that they could film 30 seconds of me.
You say you've read 110 books at this point. If you get a score, you can have a rough idea of how many criminal convictions there have now been, how many guilty pleas, that sort of thing?
Well, it's still under about 50 in terms of the convictions and in terms of the major player guilty pleas. The one that everyone knows about, Fastow, both Fastows.
Fastow, the CFO.
Right.
Wife who was, refresh my memory on her, she was in the company?
Well, Lee Fastow was also in the company. She had signed some things along with Andrew Fastow, and in a move that I'm guessing is not designed to make family reunions happy, instead of him trying to give information to the government as part of a plea deal for himself first, he let her go sit in jail for a year.
But they both ended up with jail time, right?
They did. Hers was under a year. His is 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Is he still in jail?
As far as I know, she's out and he's in.
But you say something like 50, including guilty pleas and convictions.
And convictions. Now, the broadband stuff, it's very interesting because the Fifth Circuit just said that a couple of the folks who were convicted in the I can't remember now whether it was the Nigerian barge or the broadband trial, should be released on bail. When the Fifth Circuit is nice to criminals, that means that someone's conviction is about to get overturned.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. 50-odd with... Well, yeah, I was going to say, we got 50-odd so far. Are we at the end of it, near the end of it, not near the end of it?
I think so. I don't think there's going to be any more criminal indictments. It's... At some point, it becomes less cost-effective for the government. Enron's trial was long, and it was expensive because there were no smoking guns, other than the fact that Enron's directors let Fastow engage in self-dealing and waive their own conflicts of interest rules twice to let him do it. But the directors, nothing there. A lot of the banks have settled. At least one law firm has settled in the bankruptcy case. I think last week, Vincent and Elkin settled for $30 million in Enron's bankruptcy. So things, I think, are winding down, and it's now more a question of...
We have these 50-odd convictions, and then, of course, we have the government criminal prosecution, right, of Arthur Anderson, the accounting firm?
The late, lamented, thanks a lot, Supreme Court, for ruling late, Arthur Anderson, yes. The one where the jury instructions ended up not being so good, but by that time there was no Arthur Anderson to speak of.
They destroyed the company. Now, when the curtain rises in this little drama, there were five major public company auditing firms in this country, and now there are four.
That's
Is
right.
Is it a better place with four than it was with five?
I don't know. At some point, I think that if everything works the way it should, the little companies will start getting more of a grip in the market, because one of the things Sarbanes-Oxley says is you have to rotate your auditors.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, if the musical chairs are down to one or two firms, some new guys are going to have to enter the market.
There are probably six guys that claim fifth place in this league.
Exactly.
Like opera company. I shouldn't keep coming.
That's okay. We'll just have to send you some recordings.
Oh, Sean found there something. He got this is great. So Anderson's out of business. We end up with this aggregate of 50-odd convictions. It sounds a little like counting bees at this point, but you're never quite sure which ones you've counted or which convictions still stand or something. Is that right?
I think it's still up in the air. Obviously, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling are going to appeal, and there's at least one jury instruction that will make an interesting appeal. I don't know which way it'll go.
Frame that up. Of course, we have Lay as a chairman and Skilling as CEO.
Right.
And various other titles at various times. Were ultimately indicted and brought to trial there in Houston. I forget now. The trial start back in first of this year or late last year?
Oh, I'm trying to think. It went on for at least 4 months, so I guess it started in January-ish.
Okay. Before jury trial down there, right? Okay.
Jury trial, and not only did various U.S. media covered it, I actually did a quick segment at one point with Al Jazeera.
Uh-huh.
Trying to explain Enron. At least in English. I don't know what ended up happening, but it was
because
a very out-of-body experience for me.
I never quite understood.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Okay. And we had a verdict, a few weeks ago now?
May 25th.
Okay, criminal convictions against both Lay and Sasset.
Lay was zero,
Lay and Skilling.
Yes, Lay was guilty on all counts. Skilling was acquitted on some of the insider trading counts, but convicted on everything else, so the fraud counts. Conspiracy, all of that.
My recollection is right. Lay was convicted, the same day or the next day in a parallel but separate criminal trial?
Same day, and that one was a bench trial, and that involved...
Same judge. Same judge, okay.
And the idea there was whether he had lied on statements to banks about what he would do with certain accounts.
So a bad day for Ken Lay. He loses both.
He did not have a good day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
I was a little bit. I think the thing that surprised me most is going in to the beginning of the trial, I had an image in my own mind of how I thought Ken Lay would come across to a jury and how I thought Jeff Skilling would come across. And during the course of the trial, the two personalities seemed to switch. Suddenly people were finding Jeff Skilling not such a bad guy, and they were stunned that Ken Lay was cranky and a bit imperious on the stand.
Well, now, which one had the lawyer who had to bail out because he had heart trouble in the middle?
That would be Ken Lay. And Mike Ramsey had to bail out of the trial. Mm-hmm. It was interesting because they were being tried jointly. And one thing that could have happened, I suppose, is Ken Lay could have asked to put his trial off a little bit since his lead lawyer wasn't doing well. Mm-hmm. But they kept on going.
Talk about that. Here's Ramsey, and a highly regarded lawyer, and certainly prepped up on this thing. Mid-trial, your lawyer comes down with a disabling heart condition, has to withdraw. I'm flabbergasted that they didn't seek mistrial or separation at that point.
I guess they could have, too. The other thing that surprised the heck out of me, first off, I guess I'm just not used to defendants posting comments on web blogs before they get tried. Or speaking in downtown Houston about their take of the case.
Ken Lay had, or perhaps still has.
He blogged the day of the conviction. That's the part that amazed me. I went back on and I looked at his blog again, and he was blogging about how he felt about having been convicted.
So you wonder what his lawyer told him about that.
I think I understand why Mike Ramsey had a heart attack. If my client were doing that, I would too.
Well, I guess I said like you, I'm not sure if you were flabbergasted. I was flabbergasted that they didn't do something to affect the delay. In that case, do you have any sense as to why they didn't?
I think they were... Here's part of it. I honestly think that both Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling believed they weren't doing anything wrong, which is very different from whether they did do anything wrong. But they believed they didn't do anything wrong.
Well, I've also heard it said that maybe one reason Lay didn't ask for a delay at that point is that Lay is broke.
Well, if he's not, he soon will be. And one of the things that I noticed in the most recent bankruptcy amendments pointed out to me by a student in the LLM program at St. John's is the new Ken Lay exceptions to homestead exemptions, where if you've been convicted of financial misdeeds, you don't get to claim all of your homestead is exempt anymore.
Yeah. capita income, $825,000.
Which doesn't do you real well in a penthouse in the middle of prime real estate in Houston.
You still living in a prime real estate penthouse?
Well, I keep looking up as I drive by.
Uh-huh.
The lights still seem on.
Maybe you fall from the floor.
That's true.
So, Lane loses his lawyer. Well, although I guess his lawyer was back by the end of the day.
Well, he had two other really good lawyers, and then Skilling had good lawyers. In a sense, it was the battle of the titans, both on the prosecution side and on the defense. These were superb lawyers all the way around.
And refresh my memory, I guess they both took the stand, right?
Yeah, I still don't understand that.
Yeah, help me on that.
I don't understand. Back when I was studying criminal law as a baby law student, one of the things that was fairly conventional is you don't help the prosecution by testifying against yourself. And here, it was very interesting. Skilling came across as someone who was just trying to explain sincerely that the deals were okay.
Well, let me try this. I didn't follow it nearly as closely as you did. I'm not nearly as well informed, but I followed it as a newspaper reader or something. Skilling came across to me as kind of a mad genius.
Yeah, he came across as trying to explain how a Rube Goldberg machine is actually the shortest way between two points.
And you find yourself wanting to say, my God, this guy really believes this stuff.
Yes.
Okay.
And then Ken Lay came across as someone who was cranky, who was not comfortable playing by the rules. In fact, the day he got sentenced, he didn't want to stand with his lawyers. He wanted to sit in the row behind with his wife.
Didn't you point out that he didn't even sit at the counsel table during the trial?
Well, he didn't during the sentencing. And what really... I cannot imagine if I were a criminal defendant in any court dictating where I'm supposed to stand.
Hmm.
I pretty much would go with tradition.
But you say, notwithstanding all this, you were still a little surprised at convictions, right?
I guess I was. It's still hard in some sense, even for me, even with as obsessed as I am about all of this, to reconcile the outward image and what convictions mean about what the jury thought of the evidence, because he still is very affable looking, and I think he truly believes that he has been wronged.
I think you mentioned before I cut you off that you think there's at least one really interesting appeal issue.
I think there is. One of the things that the prosecution got in was a jury instruction saying, in essence, that Skilling and Lay deliberately turned away from obvious signs that they were doing things wrong. Which, you know, in the civil sense, it's known or should have known. But this is criminal.
The conscious ignorance wrinkle?
Exactly. And what I think is going to be the difficult thing for a court, and I am not a criminal law professor by any means, as any of my colleagues who teach criminal law will tell you, is I think there's a big difference between the jury saying we're going to infer the requisite level of intent by seeing how they behaved with conscious ignorance versus knew or should have known, which is not the right standard for a criminal trial. And I don't know how a court's going to look at that, but I think it's a very interesting issue.
I guess I was going to frame it up perhaps two different ways. One is whether conscious ignorance is appropriate for a substantial criminal conviction at all. And the other is whether the issue of conscious ignorance was addressed in the trial.
The defense said, hey, you never really covered that in the trial. It is an interesting way to think about showing regular garden variety intent, though. And I think what it boils down to, and this was a very educated jury, it boils down to the jury saying, okay, maybe you got sheaves of paper from various professionals saying it was okay to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down, if you're playing a game of three-card Monty and you take away the little acorn, you know it's wrong. So it doesn't matter how many people tell you it's right, it's still wrong.
I thought it was a walnut. Okay. No wonder I never won.
We play it with an acorn down here.
I guess you probably listened to the jury postmortems after the case.
Oh, yes.
Were you impressed by the jury?
I really was. It was a very articulate jury, very defined sense of right or wrong. It would be fun someday to go back in. And I've been thinking of this, how important it is where the jurors are in their own stage of moral development when they have to sit in judgment on a crime of this type.
Hmm.
The more law and order they are, and the less I've been thinking about Kohlberg and the stages of moral reasoning, and I think...
You've also think about Law and Order as in the TV show?
Actually, you know, I'm embarrassed. I hardly ever watch it. But I think...
But the jurors do, right?
I watch Boston Legal like all good lawyers should.
Okay, no, I was going to say, you and I see the same stuff, but I guess there's been some commentary lately about the extent to which Law and Order and shows like it affect or influence jury behavior.
And I think there's a lot of that. I think that the way that people see lawyers generally as hired guns and as crooks underneath it all has a lot to do with how people see us in television shows and in movies, because most people don't know that many lawyers, and so what else are they going
to
do?
Now that you've written about that, haven't you?
I have. I've been obsessed about that, too, because some of my research assistants would rather watch movies for me than read docket sheets.
Well, hey.
It's a tough call.
So what? Now the big trial's over, what you have to do these days?
Well, right now, I am actually still thinking about Enron as I work on a book review of another big bankruptcy scandal. It's a book by Milt Regan out at Georgetown called Eat What You Kill. I don't know if you've read it.
That's a remarkable book, isn't it?
It really is. And what I'm trying to do in a book review that I've promised Brad Wendell, a year ago, but now I have more free time.
Now, wait a minute. I thought you recorded on the jacket of that book. Right?
Well, I read the book, but I'm actually writing a typical law review book review of it. And what I'm trying to
let's
do...
Let's go on the rest of the world now. Milt Regan is a, I guess, Georgetown law professor of professional responsibility.
He is, and he writes really well. And what
what's
he did was a case study of a bankruptcy lawyer who served time for lying.
Okay. Well, that would be John Jeline from...
Yes. From Milbank Tweed.
Milbank.
And what I'm trying to do is draw a parallel between the cognitive dissonance that I saw go on in my study of Enron and the cognitive dissonance that goes on in law firms when they see their partners doing things and they don't really have the comfort level necessary to confront it.
I have at least one friend who said he left his old law firm because he didn't like waking up every morning and wondering what his partners were up to.
Well, that's the thing. The bigger law firms get, at some point you know that somewhere in the world, someone in your firm is doing malpractice at any given time.
You haven't a clue who your partners are anymore anyway.
Yeah, I actually had to introduce myself to lawyers when I brought summer associates around, and I loved my firm.
Mm-hmm. Back at MoPo and things.
At that point, there were 800-plus lawyers.
Ah, yes. Okay. They were boutique ones.
Yes, they were, compared to the mega ones now.
Yeah, I got it. And you're also, I gather, involved in the ABI study of professional fees. Right?
And that's been very interesting. There is this...
Tell me another.
There's a guy named Stephen Lubben, L-U-B-B-E-N, out of Seton Hall. He's very, very good. And what he's doing is he's sampling... information about cases in big districts, small districts, rural districts, urban districts. And what he's trying to do is not so much try to come up with theories at this point about what tends to lead to higher fees or lower fees, a la Lynn Lopucky's studies, but he's trying to come up with just a description of patterns of what types of fees are triggered by what types of decisions and cases.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a bevy of law students working on it, and he has some great advisors, including Bob Lawless, formerly of UNLV, now going to be part of the bankruptcy triumvirate at University of Illinois.
UNLV being a lot of shape.
Exactly. And what Stephen's doing is he has trained his law students to code various things that tend to go on in bankruptcy cases, and track what he can from fee applications and the like and try to figure out what correlates with what. And it's a huge study, and I'm very excited that the ABI has funded it because it's important to have this information. It's important for academics so that we can start figuring out patterns of lawyer behavior. And I love Lynn Lopucky to death. I just disagree with his studies a lot of the time. So we need more than just Lynn's out
there.
That's
a professor's privilege, isn't it?
And it's the joy of having free speech again.
Yes.
Now that when I am now stepped down from being a dean, I get my free speech rights back. It's lovely. But having a simply descriptive study and having that database means that the rest of us can then tap into it and take a look at specifics as well. It's a very well thought out study.
Nancy, I'd be happy to carry this on all night if they invented virtual beer. But but let me take up one other topic.
Sure.
This is all our audience at this point. You mentioned briefly the role of the directors in Enron going back. Why don't we talk a little bit about how this is not just a bankruptcy problem, but a corporate structural problem?
Two-part question, Your Honor.
Yes.
How far do you think the Enron directors were asleep at the switch? And corollary there is, do you think Sarbanes-Oxley improved the world?
Can I do them in reverse order?
Sure.
I think that Sarbanes-Oxley has been incredibly lucrative for lawyers and accountants. And I don't think it really changes anything. It doubled some penalties. But the real crooks are never going to think they're going to get caught, so bigger penalties won't deter them. People who would never even come close to violating the spirit of the law don't need to be deterred, and the folks in the middle are probably going to talk themselves into doing things they know they shouldn't anyway. So I'm not a fan of Sarbanes. But in terms of the board, here's my beef with the board, and this is based on one night reading the Senate panel that dissected the responsibility for Enron's board.
I might add, it looked like a platinum board to an outsider, I guess.
Well, they're really smart people, but each of the independent directors had separate consulting deals with Enron. And at that point, you start thinking to yourselves, if you can't see your own conflict of interest, how are you going to see it in someone else? And that really bothered me. And it was a lucrative board. One of the things, I was being facetious about Sarbanes-Oxley. I do think that we have seen an end to the days where you have decorative famous people on boards. And I think that we've seen an end to the days where people will volunteer for the audit committee or the compensation committee who don't know what they're talking about. And those are two good things. And I think that Enron generally meant that all of us who serve on nonprofit boards actually read the financials before the meeting.
How about that?
And that is a very positive change. But fact is,
you did mention rotating auditors before.
Yeah, there are some really good things, but we had that stuff before. It's just we pulled it together in legislation, and what irked me about it is, and this is not new for Congress, Congress decided to find a solution before it had studied the problem. And that's sloppy.
That's never happened before.
Oh, I know. It's brand new development. The other thing that I think really, the lesson I try to tell law students is, and in the movie Enron used the slogan, Ask Why. Law students have a really hard time understanding that clients think about things in business terms, not legal terms, and that they have to understand what the client's business is if they're going to give good legal advice. And so if nothing else, I hope this encourages law students not to be afraid to learn business concepts and not to be afraid to ask why if they don't understand something.
You may have seen Jim White up in Michigan had a list of 10, I don't know how many mistakes that commercial lawyers make, and I think number one or two or three was not knowing what business your client is in.
It's really amazing, and they don't understand clients have budgets for legal and that they have a much higher risk tolerance than lawyers do.
Uh-huh.
We don't like any. They love it because with risk comes money.
Well, they like it, especially if our signature's on the opinion letter.
Right, and if there is someone papering the opinion at a lower level who does not understand the deal, that is scary.
Look, this is getting distracting. You've got life to get on with here. Truett Dean there is deaning at Houston right now. What's next for you? You're going to be Houston next?
I honestly don't know. This is the first time in my life that I do not know what my next step is, but I have a feeling it'll be interesting.
Nancy, keep me posted.
Absolutely. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay.
You've been listening to one of a series of podcasts that we're producing here at the American Bankruptcy Institute to help us all understand better how bankruptcy professionals do their work. We hope you found it helpful. Look on our webpage at abiworld.org for more podcast choices. This is Jack Eyre saying thank you for listening.